as I kept grasping with Paul Hewitt, is he's put out two videos called Special Relativity 1 and Special Relativity 2. And when I packaged this unit, I was always in the midst, also in the midst of marking provincial exams, and I tried to have a unit that I felt the kids could take themselves through with minimal direction, or at least my teaching overheads could cover in the gaps when it came to doing the math. And I could fix the math when I came back, but at least they would get through a number of things. So it became a really nicely packaged unit, and you can see from the outline, day one is a reading from his book, which basically is extremely highly correlated to the first video. It's probably the most highly correlated video resource you'll ever see to a text resource. And then at the end of the first video is this cute little cartoon I'm going to show you, which is called The Twin Trip. And it's done in an animation. We're only going to have time to show you 3 or 4 minutes of it. But it serves as a really concrete example that time dilation actually works. And by this time in the course, they've already studied waves, and we've gone over the Doppler effect. And they basically can buy in everything that's going on. This is the resource on the CD, and this is the example, thank you, Diana, of what you would follow up the twin trip video with. And some of you that are wondering about all the handouts that we have, the yellow sheet is this same concept development exercise, but turned around backwards so that the frame of reference changes from where the light flash of the light clock is being sourced at. So I think it's written as the ship is sending a light flash, as you see in the little excerpt I'm going to show you. And we turn around and say, let's put the light clock on Earth. And our clock becomes when the receiver receives a pulse of light. So I'd like to show you now just a couple of minutes from the video.
Intervals of time. To simplify, we're going to let the ticks of our clock be periodic flashes of light. Look at the light flashes emitted by the stationary rocket ship. Now, some time goes by before they reach the distant planet, but since there's no relative motion involved, successive flashes get to the planet at regularly spaced intervals. That's to say, both the sender and the receiver will agree on the time intervals between the flashes. Now, there's nothing unusual about this. But suppose the rocket ship moves. Look at the Doppler effect. An observer sees the flashes at shorter intervals. Suppose the ship moves fast enough so an observer sees the flashes at intervals twice as short as the ship sends them. Then if the ship moves away just as fast now, an observer is going to see intervals twice as long. Like if the rocket sends a flash every 6 minutes, they'll be seen every 12 minutes by the observer when the rocket moves away. But every 3 minutes when the rocket's approaching. Now let's apply this to time dilation. If the ship passes by the Earth and moves away at the same high speed for 1 hour and quickly turns around and then returns in 1 hour, rocket ship time, this 2 hour trip is seen by the Earth as taking place not in 2 hours, but in 2.5 hours. And this is because the ship and the Earth have been in completely different realms of time. Let's look at this in greater detail. Suppose that when the ship goes by the Earth, that clocks on Earth and on the ship are synchronized to 12 noon. Then as the rocket leaves the Earth, a flash of light is emitted by the ship every 6 minutes. That's 6 minutes rocket time. Then the ship emits 10 of these 6 minute flashes while going away from the Earth. The 10th flash is going to be emitted 60 minutes after leaving the Earth. Then the ship's clock is going to read 1 o'clock just when this 10th flash is emitted. Now suppose this is the moment that the ship turns around. Our Earth observers don't see the turnaround until they see the 10th flash. Now here it comes. It's going to take some time for it to get to them. Closer, closer, closer. Bam, there it is. 10 flashes, 12 minutes apart. That's 120 minutes, 2 hours. So that means it's 2 o'clock now on Earth. Now, the 10 flashes the ship emits when approaching the Earth, they're going to be seen 3 minutes apart. Are all 10 in 30 minutes? The first is 3 minutes after 2 o'clock, Earth time. The next is 3 minutes later, and so on, until the last flash is emitted just as the ship whizzes past the Earth. And that's going to be 2:30, Earth time.
So he'll go on in this video segment to break it down, and then he'll turn around and change the frame of reference and how the light flash is emitted from Earth and show it doesn't matter which frame of reference you use. You're still going to get a dilated effect on who's measuring this little twin trip back on Earth. So the resource you have here that's put into the CD, I did it in Word, and you can goof around with it if you like to change, and I've actually turned it into a test question and a real easy one for the kids to do, and it really serves as concrete evidence, as spooky and counterintuitive that this is, that you can't defy that type of evidence. The longer sheet that you have there is the flipped frame of reference. But you guys can all make that one with the way I've set it up on Word. So that's sort of day one in special relativity. If you look at the unit outline I have there, depending on how tight I am for time, we'll look at a nice little bit, a 15-minute bit done on the Michelson Morley experiment, and I'll issue a little short summary essay of the experiment, because that was really influential in the development of the acceptance of special relativity. It's also known as one of the most famous flops in scientific heritage and experimentation. And then I'll show the second segment, and Paul does a nice job of developing what Damien was doing, but taking it from a slightly different perspective and a little easier for the kids to understand. And then there'll be the mathy type things that we'll do. And then, and this is the real gem, I presented to people like this at lunchtime. If I only had $150 and I was only allowed to have one physics video in my whole video collection, I would seek out the episode done by the Mechanical Universe series on special relativity. I'm really kicking myself for not bringing it and asking Damien if we could have shown it today, especially if you've never seen anything on special relativity, because it does it all. Beautiful animation. I highly recommend you seek out that source. I was fortunate. I found it at my district resource center, Park Hector, and he had some capstone to my unit on special relativity. And I guess space-time diagrams on the screen for now today. So that's how I do special relativity up till 9 o'clock this morning.
Next time questions.
If you pick any two in the Hewitt series, concept development exercises, teacher edition and the student edition, the next time questions have the answers to the difficult questions.
Okay.
So Bob.
All right. For me, any of the physics that I try to do, I try to find some way to put some sort of hard data, some sort of lab work with it. And one I've always had trouble with is special relativity. Well, we happen to have close to us the Tri-University Maison facility. So we have a 4,000-ton particle accelerator about 2 hours from where we live, which helps because we went over to the DC Association of Physics teachers on a special day, and then all the teachers got to go over. And I've already had a doctor who, again, Paul?
Stan Yen.
What he did was, he gave, one of the things that he's done over there gave me a system that I could actually do a lab or a thought lab with the kids anyways. So the handout I've given you here, actually a lot of it, big chunks that are stolen from him, so I'm giving him credit for most of it, but I put it in a way that my kids could understand a little better. So what it starts off by talking a bit about how they accelerate particles. And we get a bit into the math, and the basic formula we're going to use, that we end up using, is good old QVB equals mv squared over r. In fact, if you throw a particle into a field, it moves in a circle. So what we're going to capture, just want to stop there, what we're going to do is we're going to capture all of the particles that have a given momentum. And so those particles are all captured and have a couple of particle vectors down here. So the ones that have lots of momentum, they head off this way, spin out less momentum, and then, of course, we're just going to be concerned with all the ones that have the same momentum. So what happens is we have a... We start off with pions, and the pions break down to muons, and the muons break down to positrons. And they all do this in a specific amount of time. And so all those particles with that momentum, no matter what particle they are, they've got the same momentum, they're coming through, and they hit the two detectors. Just move it down a bit here. Oh, I can do it? All right. Thanks. So then what happens? That was... I hit the wrong one, my apologies. So what happens is, as we go through the detectors keep track of where the different particles, they just keep statistically track of which particles get between the two detectors, and we end up with three different peaks, with because the positrons are lighter, they move faster, and so we end up the first peak of particles must be the positrons, the next one is the median size, right? Because if the momentums are the same, bigger particles, slower speed. And finally, the pions are at the end. And so these things are moving at 3/4 the speed of light as they come through. So what we get then is the momentum graphs for the various at various speeds for the particle accelerators. So they wire the thing up and get it going faster and faster. And so the particles come up faster and faster. And what we can do from that point by doing a little bit of math on it, and then he actually steps through and talks about how to set this up. And so we get the data, we convert them, the different masses, because they don't use standard units. So we convert them to standard units. Plus, we have to do the true elapsed time, because things are going so fast. The fact that one of the cables is 4 meters longer than the other one totally fouls everything up, so they have to actually adjust for the time, so we get the true times of the particles going through. And then what happens here is we end up going through and calculating the actual mass of the particles that are going through, you know, the mass as the particle accelerator gives us. And we look at, and then we can, then we use the relativity formulas to calculate that mass. And we find out that they're all within a couple of percent, the theory and what actually really happens. And so that's what this is basically all about. Plus it talks a bit about, and I get the kids to do it, we give them the flight times. They could read them off the graph, but I actually gave them the, flight times. And they go through and they calculate this, and we find, I think that the worst is out by about 11 or 12%. Most of them are within like a half a percent to one another. So the kids can see in real life and all the stuff we've been talking about, all this theory, it really happens. All you need is a 4,000 ton particle accelerator. And that's what this is all about. And you know, the other part of it, of course, is because when we go back and look at these graphs, just real quick, I don't take too much time here, we see that we're getting different amounts. And the reason that different things are showing up, it's pretty much because as they get faster and faster, time slows down. So whereas the pions want to decay, well, they don't decay as quickly. They don't decay as quickly anymore because time slowed down for them. So we get more and more pions the faster we go and less positrons. And you can actually see that. And that's what the last part is about, to show that, hey, not only is the are the masses changing, but things are, you know, time is stretching out for these guys. So they don't want to decay as quickly. So we get more of them going through the detectors. So that's what that's about. It's I did it for the first time last year. It's still in process of getting, hopefully, getting to be a better thing.
Did you make that this year?
Dr. Stanley, yeah, made up the basic part of it, but then I cleaned it up and added a bunch of the theory in the background so the kids actually understood what a particle accelerator was.
Nice sequencing of questions, like the way you invoked it here.
No, that's good. I have to say, I'm quite happy to steal things. Thanks for putting stuff on the CD.
Diana, for the website, for in blue there, Resorts has one S.
Yeah,
I knew
I did.
It's just
that
you confused all.
Yeah,
well,
that's me.
Yeah.
Because
I'm stuck from
there.
Yeah. May I just tag onto the end of Bob was saying, the Tri-University Maison facility in UBC, they actually have a lot of resource on their website for teachers to use. Mm-hmm. They also have a, they've been running for 2 years a lot of Saturday lectures that are designed for the general public, some of which have the presentation on the that you can download from the Triumph website. And that gives some ideas on things you can talk about to your students, such as applications and so forth from some Thomas articles. You might want to check that out and, you know, just go on Google search for Triumph, T-R-I-U-M-F or Triumph University Maisage Facility.
All right, thank you. Okay, I've only been teaching modern physics and physics in general for the last couple years, so I hope this is a good resource. I just picked it up this year. I caught it on PBS when I was home one night, and I think it's an excellent resource for most people's physics courses. It basically takes you, I think they're, most of them are organized such that electromagnetism comes, and then you have your modern physics section. And the way that this video is organized is the exact same way. You kind of start with Michael Faraday, and you move on to just all different types of physicists over the years that kind of contributed to Einstein's thinking when he came up with his theory of relativity and E equals mc squared. One reason why I kind of wanted to pass this information on to you is, as many of you probably already know as educators, PBS doesn't charge any educational fees when it comes to showing it at your school. It's a nonprofit organization, so 1995 American is not bad for a resource. And I did show this to my students. I actually watched the whole thing for the first time with them, and I got some feedback with them, and they just found it was really excellent. One thing that stands out for this video is new 2005, and a lot of the digital imagery that they have in it is really unique in the sense that when Einstein, for example, is explaining how he visual, or when he's kind of getting his ideas about relativity, rather than just him talking to someone else about it, it kind of goes inside his mind. Like, there's one scene, for example, and I didn't bring it with me, unfortunately, because my school was already closed before I got this email. But he sees a train go by, and he kind of has a spark of an idea about, just, he says to himself and to his wife, he's, what would it be like to travel on a beam of light? And as opposed to just saying it, like, you can actually see what he's visualizing. And the feedback that I got from my students was that that was what they found the neatest, because sometimes our resources are a bit stagnant. Mm-hmm. And just to have that, you know, how exactly they imagine things gave them some context. Also, the historical connections with the electromagnetism, I find sometimes with modern physics is a bit disjointed, and they don't really get the connections and how people move so from one topic, classical, to modern, and it just gave them a context to put it in, and they thought that was really valuable. And it, of course, it does fit into most people's curriculum, so that's pretty much it. Great.
Okay.
That's 2 hours long, if you want to know that.
So these are just actually, these little MP3s are just quotes from Thompson, Rutherford, and Bohr. The Thompson one is really, really good, where he talks about, and if I could imitate a British accent, I would. He talks about millions of these things being on the head of a pin and taking up space, and he's all excited. And so there are various places on the internet. I've got a bunch of different spots.
Small, that this mass is an be too small to have been detected by any means, then know the science.
He actually spoke those words in about 1927 or something. And the other thing was this thing. Yeah, this looks pretty standard, but actually I saw this demonstrated at a science conference once, and I was quite surprised. Probably most of us do the thing with the laser behind the diffraction grating projected onto the board or something like that and measure. But I was surprised when I saw this, because basically you can take a spectral tube of any gas, but I saw it done with hydrogen. Hydrogen's the important one as far as our high school physics goes. And you can set your grating so it's a meter away from the tube, and then set a meter stick out at a right angle like this. And then when you look through the grating, what you see is you see the meter stick, but you see the little lines right on the meter stick. And it happened, you can do it with the window, no blinds, you can do it in perfect daylight. And so you can see on your meter stick there, you can see the three spectral lines, and from that you can calculate the wavelengths of the lines, and then they can use the formula. I know that in different parts of the country, you don't write the formula the same way we do in Alberta, but I've heard that we're very progressive in Alberta. From that, you know, they can calculate predictions ahead of time, and they can use the thing and compare them and get a percent error and so on. So, and we also have the privilege, too, as we get to go to the University of Alberta and redo the experiment using nice spectroscopes with Vernier and Engel scales on it and so on. But this helps prepare you for that.
Rob was saying that you can also measure the wavelength using flashlight, CD, and meter stick. Measure the wavelength by just shining the flashlight onto the CD and reflects nice sound to the ceiling onto a wall and just measure directly off of that. So that is the concept. Okay, so what I have here is a handful of shareware, freeware, mostly freeware programs, which I've downloaded off the internet over the years. But as I pointed out, a few of these I've just mentioned very briefly what some of these can do. This first one, each program, by the way, is in separate folders. That's why there's a full stack of folders here. The first one here is an electric field simulator. You can visualize what the electric field looks like. You can put in various parameters. You can see the electric fields and the magnetic fields propagating outwards from an antenna. Students find it very useful because you talk about these things, you can actually visualize them. And you can do the dipole antennas, the quadrupoles, all kinds of more complicated things like that. This one here is very similar to that, the harmonic simulator. Kinetic here, sort of more related to chemistry, but what this program does, a very, very simple program. It looks very, very old. I think it was made in 86 or something like that. But it runs very quickly. It simulates about 300 or 400 particles. You talk about the individual collision between particles, you can track individual particles, you look at Brownian motion, things like that. It works very, very nicely, even though it's a very old program.
Can I open up just one of them and somebody
can see sure. So this is a program I was just talking about, and you get a velocity distribution. Unfortunately, these computers today run way too quick for this program. So you see in the top corner, you see it, you can't quite see it here. You see the particle running around, and you get a nice velocity distribution here. And I believe it's, you can hear the individual particles hitting the walls. I'm just pressing some F buttons here. You can see one individual particle running around, and you can turn on and off the collisions as well. There we go. So now it's colliding with individual particles, or you can turn off the collisions and just have the individual particles running around with no collisions at all. And you can do various other things as well. There's says here that you have a handful of different types of simulations that you can do. You know, Maxwell's demon that started out there as well. So that's that one. So that was this one here called the Kinetic. This Noken oil drop experiment simulator works relatively well. This is an optics program which I wrote about 10 or so years ago, optical simulator. You know how if you have a lens, those lenses and mirrors concave and convex. Let's say I have a lens, a convex lens. So you have a convex lens from an object. You always draw your image as a vertical line. In fact, this program shows it's actually a curved line in reality. Okay, because the distance is, because if you're always doing thin lens approximation, your lens are, in actual fact, different thicknesses. All your equations assume that it's zero thickness. And the program here shows that it is actually curved. You can raise and lower them, change focal lengths, and change all the distances using all the keys that are on the program. This one here I found the orbital simulator. It's not actually installed on this machine, so I can't actually run it. It's an orbital simulator. It plots the wave function for any atom, any number of electrons, any number of protons and neutrons, so that you can see the orbitals around the various atoms. You can build molecules. You can attach various atoms to them and look at what the orbitals and the electrons, using all the wave functions that we talked about in quantum mechanics, that actually plots these things, so you can see the probability distributions for the electrons around the atoms. And students found it very, very useful. It's also close tie-in to chemistry, of course. You can talk about the different orbitals and how that relates to bonding in chemistry.
You don't think we have time to actually talk about all of them, or are there any?
There's one more. I'll just talk briefly about it. I don't see it here.
Exams.
So these are the Alberta Diploma exams. I moved here from Alberta last year. And so this is the handful of exams from 1996 up till 2002, all the exams. So you can use that too. These are all in public domain, so not copyright or anything like that. You can cut and paste questions and use them. And I also have other courses if you want to email me and contact me, I can get you a handful of the courses as well.
Okay. Good, thanks.
Not being a physics teacher, I don't have any physics resources, and I wasn't originally planning to submit anything. And then I thought, if your students are like mine, maybe the occasional diversion is required. And one of my favorite diversions is in the area of geography. So I wrote this thing called Bill's Atlas Companion. I'm Bill. and I found that it's actually worked remarkably well for me with the kids and just general interactions with them. In the companion, or using the companion, I claim to be able to teach the average high school student all the countries in the world, all their capitals, and how the countries are interconnected with each other in a fairly short period of time. It's only 500 or 600 pieces of data, and I say they probably have that many CDs in their collection. So. These hieroglyphics are symbols of places in the world. There's an introduction where I talk about a high school student or maybe a university student with a backpack going through Europe, meeting someone from the opposite gender in a train, and saying, where are you from? And the answer Slovenia is given, and either you know nothing about Slovenia, or perhaps maybe you do. It's a little story there. Just to try to convince people that when you meet people and you find out they're from a different place, and you say, oh, are you from? But it just starts up a conversation, and everything runs very nicely from there. The basis of the Atlas Companion is, can I move forward here? Those regions of the world there. So member states of the UN, non-member states, 191 countries. So the hieroglyphics correspond to each of the regions. You see the North America, West Indies, Caribbean, South America, start in, I think, Bolivia. Walk through all the countries in South America once and get to the end. So all the hieroglyphics have kind of a Europe, a Nordic line, a Anglo-Germanic line, a Franco-Romanian line, a Southern line in the Balkans. Middle East is kind of interesting, with Saudi Arabia in the middle. So all the way through. And then, so discuss these. And each of the regions, and how to go about memorizing the countries and the regions. North America is pretty easy, except for the Guatemala area. And so going through a little did you know section in each of these, and all the way through the regions, and then at the end, yeah, that's right. Well, no, there's a quiz material. Where are we? Getting there? Oceania, okay, that's the last one. Oh no, Antarctica, of course. And then quiz material. So sometimes I do this with the kids. Six member states if I'm more than one capital, 16 member states where the capital is roughly the same name as the country. So stuff like that. Answers for you guys. and then all, yeah, so there you go. Put that on CD and do with it what you will.
I went to the book that Amy recommended, and it's a greedy, the Thomas More's book, and it's a very, very well done, thorough, not probably the book you give to your students, but it made me more comfortable space-time diagrams. And in here, it's basically space-time diagrams for dummies. I simplified it as far as you can without losing, I think, anything key there. And there are there's basically a standard piece of space-time diagram graph paper. I think maybe I should just open that one. So it's drawn up for a speed of 3/5 C. 3/5 C is really nice because gamma comes up to be 5/4. So we're down to simple fractions. And with this fancy graph paper, you can do all the problems that Daniel will be taking through tomorrow and more. And so in the folder are some exercises with answers that I've looked up for my students. And I'd love to hear back from anybody who's working on using these in the classroom so that we can share with us.
Is this the stuff you reported copying?
Yeah. So I have some copies. Well, if anybody wants to look at it ahead of time, particularly the people from DC are doing relativity right now and so forth. So let me know. I want to meet other people who are working with these.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
Resources that I've used from grade 11. I didn't make them up myself. I got them from another sharing session when I was at Queen's doing my BA. The first one is a bunch of physics teaching ideas, which I'll let you guys go through. Maybe I'll show you the one that I've used in grade 11. But Tom Russell was my physics prof when I did my BA at Queen's, and amazing guy. And he was one of the guys who I'll put this package together. So I'll just show you one thing from here. We've been talking about space-time graphs, and I find that I've only talked for 1 year, but found that students had a major problem with position time graphs. And so this activity, which I'm trying to find right now, is a match graph challenge. Okay, so yeah, basically. There's a series of position time graphs, velocity time graphs, and acceleration time graphs on this handout. And with the kids, basically what I do is I try and get them to go through in pairs and explain each graph using dynamics cards. Just set up a lab bench, mark off the reference point, positive, negative direction, and get them to work in pairs to try and explain the motions going on, and then demonstrate it in front of the class with the dynamics card. And I also get them to match up position time graphs with velocity time graphs, make sure that they make the correlation there, because I find that they have a really hard time with that. so I imagine they would probably have a very hard time making the jump into the space-time graphs that we've been talking about. So that was one of them. The other one, which is kind of cool, and you can kind of turn it into a little magic trick if you want, is disappearing Pyrex test tube. It's using canola oil and Pyrex, and they both have the same index of refraction. So you can, if you wanted to turn it into a magic trick, you can basically hide a Pyrex test tube inside a beaker of canola oil. If the test tube is also filled with canola oil, you won't see it in there. Then you can, if you don't mind wasting some glassware, you can break one, throw it in there, and then magically pull out an entire test tube. And try and get them to explain what the heck is going on, kind of as an introduction to light and how we see things based on reflection and refraction of ray sources. So that's what this resource will tell you, and there's a little table at the bottom. So you can look at that. You can do that same thing with microscope slides and glycerin, and they're cheaper. And they're cheaper microscope slides.
Very similar to the board. It seems that it's a basic teaching job that they seem to work most of the time. If you have students like mine, you will find them very difficult to convince. So teaching the quantum theory, we have a few answers, a few points that gives, give you a hard time until you are fully convinced that, okay, that's it, I can't say anything anymore. One of them is that wave particle love. I'm going to write them first so I can forget. The other one is threshold frequency. And we come after that the photoelectric effect, black body's photoelectric effect. And that way, you can use your soul. And after that, I have a lab that I have put together here. I have hard copies of it, I need them, and if you'd like to have them, they're also on CD. I'm sure they're going to need a passive copy of it. To put things together, large number of variables. dealt with, we have to deal with. Let's get to the first one.
Is it possible you could just describe a lab to us?
Sure.
Yeah, but if it's going to take much time, just...
No, I won't take much time.
Okay.
No, I'll go quickly.
Okay.
I'll make a little demo.
Okay.
And then after that, I'll see it just...
Yeah.
So how much time do you give me? 5 minutes?
Sure.
Okay. So when we come to the wave particle blood, I usually just draw a wave, which is, we look at this. It's a perfect wave. You can't say anything about it. And if we're dealing with photons, we're dealing with electromagnetic waves. So we know that there is another accompanying wave at 90 degrees that accompany this. So we have this wave and we have that wave. And so already if we look at focus on this here, we find that we have points of zeros. And we can see concentration of energy here. And if if we turn a circle around this, like this is polarized, we will find here more of these. In other words, we're going to have a ball here, a ball of energy. If we repeat that in every lambda over 2, which is between the zeros here, we're going to have this. So what is perfect wave? Now we can see the perfect particle as well. I usually have this, and if I, a little part of it, if I put it here, something larger, tighter, eye, necklace or something, and we can put it here. I call it the rosary. The rosary. So why it is a perfect wave, it is a perfect particle. So as it travels as wave. And as it hits the surface, when we come to photoelectric effect, while bombarding a surface with package of energy, while bombarding the surface with perfect particles. That's how my kids have said the explanation of this. Perfectly perfect particles. If we come to the next one, which is...
Thank you, you've got 1 minute.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, I might just go to the demo.
Yeah.
I have our geometer, and one side of it is black body, and that body is a surface that can absorb 100% of the energy by photon wave. And the other side is shiny surface. So what do you do? I have a flashlight, and I aim it at the flash at the white side first. As you see, no rotation is taking place. Now, I'm going to aim my flashlight at the black side of it. Black surface. So, we can see now that the veins are turning in a certain direction. And what happens is, if the light is hitting the black surface seems to be pushed away. If we go back to momentum and Newton's third law, action reaction, we notice that the electrons being ejected from the surface, they are pushing. So the surface is ejecting the electrons, and the electrons are pushing back on the surface, and that's what makes it. The other thing that I have in this lab, I'm not going to talk about that. What does this lab handle? We have a lot of things, and similar quantities are used in quantum theory. For example, if we consider frequencies, we have threshold frequency, and we have other frequency, of the voltage falling down. If we consider voltages or potential, not many voltages, or voltages in joules, or voltages in electric volts, we have the retarding potential, and we have work functions, which is another voltage, another potential that brings the electric to the surface. We do a lot of things here, and this lab, all I want to say about it is, it puts all these things together. I consider it as a lesson, as a practical lesson. I got this lab from my book. I did a little bit changes on it, but what you can do is you go with it step by step. If you leave the kids on their own, you say you have the information to the lab, you'll get frustrated. That's a teaching, that's continuous to the lesson, that you do every step with them, one step back with them, and you let them do the next thing on their own, and so on. So
thank you, sorry.
Completely open. You can use it. You can order a T-shirt or a mug from him. He wants it out there. It's public domain. So you can put it on your test and not feel guilty. Unfortunately, it's a little hard for you to see. But this actually is about the level of my understanding of the Copenhagen interpretation. It's talking about quantum smearing of chickens. And that's why the chicken is on me.
How do you do it this way? Maximize it and do it this way.
Also,
yeah.
Go to the top left on the password. It's a beautiful slideshow.
The other left.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, cool.
Well, and you just click back one. You just click it and go forward.
Okay. This election and stuff. I'll come back. This is the one that I actually found originally.
Okay. Going back to the beginning. There we go.
All right. I won't go through all of these. What's nice is that there's stuff on what we've been talking about, on quantum mechanics, on the interpretation. And this is really, of course, why the chicken went to the other side of the road, the only correct explanation. But where I ran into, where I found it originally.
You want to read? Oh, wait, we didn't let you read them. We can't see 5 minutes.
Next, that's just another variation on the same thing. This is the one that, when I'm talking about particle interactions, and
I have to move on to this.
Yeah, exactly.
No,
to
the next one.
You have to step back.
This is fairly appropriate for where we are. Sorry. And this one I didn't get. And when I was reading. I like this part of it, going through beer and suddenly being attracted to almost anything. But it was the neutrino guesses versus neutrino notes. This one. So with particle interactions, my students have no problem with electrostatic repulsion. You've got the exchange of the two virtual photons in between, and they can say, OK, conservation momentum, that makes complete sense. And that's the only one I had. And then another student said, well, what about attraction? And I didn't have a very intelligent answer at the time. And this, of course, is the explanation right here, because you define the momentum of those virtual photons so precisely that you can't locate them, and so it is perfectly legitimate for the cannonball to effectively come back and hit you from behind, which is what the virtual photon does. Anyway, that's it. So that's the web page. He's got all kinds of wonderful cartoons. I just pulled out most of the ones that are appropriate to our discussion.
I don't think that website's anywhere on the ECB, right?
No, I wasn't that clever.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I'm going to shorten it up because we are already 12 minutes over time.
Okay, so I've chosen something outside the realm of quantum physics, and I'm very well graduating quantum shortly. In 2 years, we'll be doing a standard model. But something that I find is really important, I feel, in a physics class, is to try to take apart some of the misconceptions kids have. And I do a media project where the kids are going to pick a commercial, a movie, or something, and try to break it apart and take a look at whether the physics is real or not. And I think it's so important because the kids are exposed to so much media, and they so often can see guns going off, cars falling off cliffs, and things. This becomes more reality than real. They keep on being reintroduced to myths over and over again and never actually see reality. And I tell them, you're fortunate. I'm glad you don't see people getting shot. You don't see cars falling off cliffs. But unfortunately, they're left with a big string of misconceptions. And so this is a list, and this actually was plagiarized, as most of us do, out of someone else. And this came from a website called Amazingly Stupid Movie Physics. And there's all sorts of things that happen that people just accept, that anything you place at the end of a gun will reduce a big 120 decibels to a sort of sound. And so I do this project later in grade 12 because I want to be completely open. They can approach it from any area they want. It can be dynamics. It can be anything they want. Energies, it doesn't matter. And so introducing misconceptions, and we talk about those. And then I treat it as a very serious lab. I tell them that in this, you have to do something that is plausible. And so approaching tiger kind of things where people just spin and float up the air, I don't want them to do that because there's no plausibility in it. Pick something that seems reasonable, and it can be from a movie, TV, it doesn't matter, just use a DVD. And I use an experiment setup where they create a problem statement. They have to do the physics ahead of time in a prediction to say, if a person fell for 3 seconds because they jumped off a cliff and were in midair for 3 seconds, could someone survive with their x-axis coming to rest in 1 meter? And they have to do the physics calculations to figure out how much force would be required to bring a person to rest in 1 meter after falling, pre-falling for 3 seconds. Then they have to go through and analyze it. And I'm treating it like any other experiment where I want to see a procedure for how they're measuring. Frame by frame, how do you determine the time index? And for movies, it's a tricky thing because it may be filmed at 28 frames per second. It may be a digital video at 30 frames per second. It may be a CGF at, who knows, 67 frames per second. And so they're going to have to research that for the time index. How are you doing your measurements? How are you doing your scaling? Is all part of the procedure. Evidence tables, analysis I'm looking for, and an evaluation, including uncertainties, parallax, and aspects like that. I want them to articulate that. Another aspect that I'm really big on in this particular thing is doing kind of a little mini thesis defense, is that they're going to present their findings to a group. They're going to give them an overview of what they did, how they did, and what they found, and then allow the other students to question them on it. And they get some good questioning. How did you do this? How did you deal with the scaling factor? Where did you reference this? And it's a good activity.
Okay.
Is Webster on CD for that? No. So, amazingly stupid movie physics. One word.
All one word?
But yeah, the, just search for amazingly stupid movie physics and you'll find a website. No.
Okay, it turns out that what I'm going to show you is similar to what Henry was going to do, so I'm not going to overlap anything that he did. But I will say that I do like some of the old DOS programs. Some of them are better than Java. But with our computer, it's so fast, the program won't even run. So instead of showing the simulation, which I think will probably be a repeat, I included in your folder that will be on your CD something called DOSBox. And lucky for us, there's a lot of people that like to play the old DOS games, so they have to slow things down. And if you download this on your computer, then you're able to run all those simulations a lot slower. So you can actually see everything the way that you would have seen it 20 years ago. Because the Millikan, this is the file, these are the files here, the Millikan X is the one you want to run. But if you run it on your regular computer, everything goes so fast that basically the screen comes up, runs it, and then closes before you get to see anything. So what you do is you download this, and I've included the instructions on how to use it. So you download this, run it, open the file, and this might work for some of his files as well. Run the file for Milken, run this one, in the DOS box, and everything slows down. And you're finally able to use all that stuff. Because some of the Java apps, especially for Milken, you don't get to change any of the parameters. It's just like one drop, another drop, there's no timer, there's no nothing. So this will help you a lot. And I've included...
Can I get out of here? Go to your knees.
Okay. Yeah. So here's the handout for that I've created for the Milken in particular. You can make it as complicated as you want. You can go into Stokes Law if you like. Blah, 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 blah. But here's the important part. This is where you can see how to run these programs, these old DOS programs, in your regular Windows. So I've included the extra instructions there. And also the instructions on how to actually use the program, which keys to press, whatnot. And I highly recommend it. It's so much better than any of the Java applets, but it's just particularly to experiment with anything else we've ever seen. That's my... This is... This is the screen capture, so you can sort of see it's old school, but you're able to even measure terminal velocity. You can mark a particular point, and then it will time for 4 seconds, mark another point, so you can include terminal velocity, which is another great grade 12 concept. And here's some sample data, so you can see the type of data that gives you to get it. I don't want to go too long, but I just really want to ask you. Diane's going to be talking about the OAPT. The conference and the contest, and next year I'm going to be writing the contest.
Yay!
Oh, okay. Oh, you look young and fresh face. Would you like to do part of the organization?
Sure.
Next thing I know, I'm running the contest. So if you have any questions that you would like to see on the contest next year, please feel free to email me or approach me. That's it.
Thank you.
Great question.
People here from Ontario, and they will tell you that we were just here last month at our annual meeting of the Ontario Association of Physics Teachers. And so I thought I'd take a minute just to let those of you who aren't members of the OAPT know about it, because somebody asked me yesterday, you know, what other kinds of workshops and things are there to do in Ontario, and this is certainly a big one, and many people who are here from Ontario can tell you about the conference that we had here last year, and this is a picture actually from the year before when we were at Sudbury, and we actually got to go down and tour
the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory. So the Ontario Association of Physics Teachers has some major, four major things that we do. There's a newsletter that comes out four times a year. There is a grade 11 physics contest, which Sarah was just speaking of. And there is the grade 12 photo contest. Now, I realize that most of you are not from Ontario, but that doesn't preclude you from being members of our association. It costs a whopping $8 for a membership for a year.
You will receive
those four newsletters, and within those newsletters you'll get information about our conference, which is always the weekend after the long weekend in May. And that's something that if you live in Quebec or somewhere close down, it might be possible for you to come. The photo contest is designed specifically geared for grade 12 physics students in Ontario. So you're not really eligible to participate in that contest if you're outside the province. However, have a look at the contest. I run photo contests in grade 11 and grade 12 as a requirement for my course, and it's really fun. And here's the first place winner from this year, which is actually showing some polarization effects. So there's lots of really neat stuff that you can do that is related to polarization and wavelength theory. So, and last year, some of the teachers found it convenient that if they wanted to join the OAPT, that I would accept their $8, make a list of their address to which they'd like their newsletter sent, and I would be happy to submit those on behalf of you all right here, and then save you the trouble of finding out who to send it to and where to send it and such. So if you want to sign up, I'll get a list going, and just give me $8 and your address, and you're in.
Is your conference Friday, Saturday, and Sunday? Or?
It starts Thursday night with workshops, and Saturday, Friday, and all week Saturday. Okay. And Dave Gall is on the executive of the OAPT, and most of the people here are regular attendees. And so ask them about it. Great. Unfortunately, we have to postpone once again.
Oh, no.
But we promise that we will get this experiment in.
We'll get to it.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll take a microwave.
Yeah. Now we'll do the microwave experiment. We might even be able to fit it in this afternoon. You never know. Right? So, but stop. Okay. So Roberta is going to come next, Dave will be my beautiful assistant.
Oh, sure.
I much prefer to zap you.
So that one means, and Diane hates this, that one means, can we come back up here? We're going to try to be quickly because we're 25 minutes up. I probably can do that. So we're looking specifically at one particular item that came out of the physics education research. This is my book version. So the name, Eric Mender, your instruction, you get hold of it. It's a good book. I don't think you actually need it. I think the technique is pretty solid. Okay. So, you got your little letters?
Mm-hmm.
We've got the letters? Okie dokie. I'm going to show me your letter. Whoa! Okay, I think I better tell you about it. Thank you very much. There's not a right answer, right?
Yeah.
That was a survey. It lets me know most of you have not heard of it. A few of you have. So that means I should actually bother to tell you something about it. All right, he's legit. He's a physics prof at Harvard, okay? And have you had that problem? You put together this brilliant lesson. In fact, while putting together, you finally understood yourself. You explain it so clearly, and then you test them on, they don't know what the hell he said. Right? He had the same problem. They all loved him, gave great student reports, but he wasn't satisfied because he weren't getting it. So he did some studies, and surprise, surprise, most students, we're students too, you don't learn by listening. You certainly don't listen wrong by not listening. You learn by being actively involved. And so we've been trying to do bits of this, but we're just going to crank it up a notch here. So the specific technique here is to have concept questions, and we've already had Paul Hewitt mentioned as a great, great source of concept questions. To get them involved, even a huge lecture calls. Now, if you have a small class, maybe you don't have to have all the fancy equipment. You have fancy equipment, those little flip charts, that's fancy equipment. You can use the whiteboards as well. You can test if they know the start. I did that, right?
Yeah.
If you don't know about this stuff. And when you focused on the concepts, they did better on concept problems, well, duh, right? But they also did better on the traditional calculating stuff. He said he'd be satisfied if that was state level, but in fact they did better on the standard calculating problems. And so in physics education research, the key thing I like about these people is they actually test, they come up with an educational idea, they test to see if it works. That's not always the case with some of the lame stuff that we are told to do. Okay? So they test and see if it works. So we're going to try it out here. We're going to be looking at the polarization of photons. You've heard a bit about this over this time. I'm hoping that the stuff at the beginning is straightforward, and then bit by bit, some of you are going to get to the point where you didn't know something, but you're going to learn something, and I hope just what everybody learns something by the end. I did not know this stuff when I came to the class. It's a big surprise to me. Let's keep this individual. Show me your letter. What do you think?
Whatever you say.
Okay. Fantastic. Nice sir. It's not all the same, but I'm going to move a little bit faster. Most of you are saying to me, I have a polarizing filter, hey, the real thing. And I'm looking through this here, and you're all looking a little bit dim. It's no good my looking through this. Like, you need to look through this. I have one. I'll put it here, right? And oh, this was different from it. Oh, okay, the different colors. Oh, my screen at home. Okay, this is not going to work now. I should have tried
to get a little bit more.
Yeah, but the thing is, we're getting the different colors are polarized in different directions.
Yeah,
45, you can still.
Yeah,
don't get on. Oh, and I'm really messing up.
You know what it is?
Yeah, and also the Twitch all about Quebec too. Oh, you can only one at a time, right?
No.
Oh, that's so scary. There we go.
No, because
this is not a piece of work. Okay, all right, we're going to have to skip the hands-on part, but I have a lot of Polaroids. Okay, we're going to have to skip the real, the concrete stuff. Into that. So, yes, the overhead, the normal overhead projector that this is getting way too fancy. And how do we get back to here?
It's coming. It came and went.
Well, while we're waiting, can I hear my other
sounds? Have you been recording from the taller things?
Well, there's just a couple of four sounds. If you know what cool things you're going to tell the person next.
Oh, was there?
All right. Okay, so back to the proper lesson. So B is the correct answer, but not everybody had it. So we are going to move things a little bit quickly. Could I have somebody explain why B is the right answer?
Only some of the lights. Okay, only some of the light will be in plain polarized complexity for the rest of it. That will get through the rest of it all.
Okay. Anybody want to add to that?
Only the light that matches the polarization orientation of the polarization grid will get through from the rest of the stuff.
Excellent. Anybody want to add to that? Yes.
The vertical component that gets through, but the horizontal component gets canceled out. So half the component gets through, so half the intensity gets through.
How does that? Okay, we're going to move on with that one. Okay, that one's off a while. Show me your letters. Those are coming in. And it's 97% D. Yes. However, it wasn't 100%. So, Ron, can you give us...
I think D.
You know, I mean, you're right. I'm set. Ron, I'm skipping you as a star pupil. Can you... The recovery group didn't have D. Can you explain as clearly as you can why it should be D?
Because if you took half out the first one, you will take the rest out. The vibrations with the second one.
I'm pretending that I'm still not convinced. Can we have some other words? Yeah.
If assuming we lost the vertical to begin with, now what it's doing is all we'll have is horizontal coming through. The next filter at 90 degrees then wants to keep the vertical, which isn't there anymore. All that's left is horizontal, so now it's all.
Nice. Excellent. Okay. You know what? This just looks like differently. For comfort zone, turn to people nearby, chat amongst yourself until you have a consensus, okay? Before you go public, okay? Grab someone near you.
Thank you. Vertical, horizontal, we take out half, and half the half is a quarter.
Great. And a key word there, components. Nice, very nice. So I don't need to have someone after him, Ron.
I'm going to come down. That's what I did to teach
him. Don't chat at this time, let's just do an individual.
No. Yes.
Your first thought of your letter. First thought. Just you need to be wild and brave and dangerous. This is good for getting a variety. It's nice. Alright, we have people who are playing the letter.
Because I'm a very visual learner, yeah. And I have to draw. I have to draw pictures.
And you like to see pictures. Okay, yeah. Tell you what, right now, turn around, find someone with a different answer or someone who doesn't know the answers, draw pictures. Thank you very much. Draw pictures.
I'm going to go to the next one.